Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. As always, thank you to Ron Trammell and the Cats Tribute Band for our bumper music. Today is March 12th, 2021, a Friday morning here in Nashville. Cloudy skies and warm temperatures. Here at our house, we have been able to get the early vegetables planted, and so we have radishes and arugula about to come up. Before we get started with our program today, let me encourage our listeners to follow us on our Facebook page. We have a special page called the Mark Fraley Podcast. And if you friend us there, you will see announcements of each new program, as well as updated information on the topics we discuss. On this page, you can also comment on a program should you desire to do so. Also, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes and be automatically notified when a new program has been posted. As always, we love to hear your comments. Today's interview is another in our series of conversations with individuals who have received the Fellow Award from the Tennessee Recreation and Parks Association. My guest today is my old friend and colleague, Jerry Dillehay, who will be speaking to us remotely from his home in Mesa, Arizona. Jerry has had a remarkable career in parks and recreation and in public service. With deep roots in Tennessee and a quiet leadership style, he guided the administration of the Land and Water Conservation Fund in Tennessee from its early days. Jerry was instrumental in the creation of the Parks and Recreation Technical Advisory Service and oversaw the establishment of the Tennessee Local Parks and Recreation Fund. Each of these things, of course, has been essential to the building and the success of the Parks and Recreation movement here in Tennessee. Jerry continued his career in Arizona after leaving Tennessee and made some contributions there. Many of you who are Parks and Recreation nerds, like I am, have seen the ubiquitous bronze plaques posted in many of our parks memorializing that a particular park has benefited from funding from the Land and Water Conservation Fund. Such a permanent memorial is required by National Park Service regulations. I posted a picture of one such plaque on our Facebook page just yesterday. The story is that our guest today did the original design of that plaque for use in Tennessee. The National Park Service liked it so much that it became the model for use by other states, and you will see it all over the country. And so I hope you will enjoy our conversation today with my wonderful friend, Jerry Dillehay. So Jerry Dillehay, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Hey, Mark. Thanks. Good to be here.
It's really great to have you. As an orientation, I'm speaking to you from Nashville. You are in Mesa, Arizona?
That's right.
All right. So that's just terrific. It's fun to be able to have this correspondence, even at a long distance. Jerry, I want to spend some time with you today talking about your history in the parks and recreation field, especially that here in Tennessee. But as we get started, I always like to ask my guests about their inspiration to be part of this field of parks and recreation and conservation generally. Mm-hmm. I know you grew up in Nashville. Tell me about your growing up and maybe a little bit of what inspired you to get involved in this field.
Well, since you ask, I think I spent a lot of summers. Actually, I was farmed out to my uncles in Smith County, Al Gore country, to spend the summers with them. And I spent a lot of time going alone through the woods. I fell in love with being out in nature, fell in love with the rural life, although I lived in a suburb of Nashville. But I think that's probably where it all started, really, as I felt very comfortable by myself out in the woods and saw a life of something that would lead me in that direction.
That's really fun. I know that you have family up in Smith County for, I guess, generations up in that country.
That's right. Both sides of the family. Yeah.
Tell me more about that.
Actually, this is a funny story. My My dad lived in Difficult, Tennessee.
Difficult. I love that.
He married my mom, who lived in Pleasant Shade, Tennessee, and they moved to Defeated, Tennessee.
That's just great. That's just
but
great.
But then they finally got to Nashville and everything looked up after that. So,
yeah, and your dad was an employee of Metro Schools for many, many years.
That's right. Yeah, right. Yeah, he was in charge of all the painting maintenance for all the Metro. My mom was too. She was a cafeteria manager in Nashville on the public schools as well.
Fantastic. You graduated Madison High School.
That's right.
And then decided to go to UT and seek a degree in forestry.
That's right.
Tell us about that.
Actually, I went my first 2 years at Western Kentucky, which is now Western Kentucky University in Bowling Green.
Okay.
In pre-forestry. And UT did not have a forestry school, but I knew that they were planning to start one. So after 2 years, I transferred to Knoxville and was in the first graduating class in forestry school there.
Jerry, I never knew that. I thought that that forestry program had been longstanding before you were there.
No, there was like 12 of us in the first class.
That's fantastic. And you, do I recall that you had an emphasis in forest recreation?
Yes, my advisor, Dr. Schell, was the professor in charge of that. And he led me in that direction more than anything because although I like being alone out in the woods, I'm also really comfortable meeting new people and I'm a people person. And so it's kind of a juxtaposition, but recreation allows you to work with people in an outdoor setting. So
super.
It was natural for me.
Well, that's terrific. And I know I've been in the woods with you enough to know you still retain a very, very fine knowledge of tree identification and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that was my favorite subject, dendrology. And we spent a lot of time in the Smokies, which has the largest collection of species in the United States. And it made the course all that much more vivid because we were in the thick of it. So yeah, identification and knowledge of trees was my bag.
Fantastic. I have to tell you that as I remember traveling with you around Tennessee, and we did it quite a bit, you and I, one of my favorite recollections is traveling with you out just to the south of Jackson, Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
And you took me to a little plot of land up on a hilltop where the forestry division had set out some test trees.
Mm-hmm.
And you showed me a monkey puzzle tree that they had planted out there. Do you remember this little spot?
I don't.
I could take you there tomorrow because it's such a vivid memory. The monkey puzzle tree. Tell us what a monkey puzzle tree is rather than me try to say.
Don't even remember, Mark. I'm sorry. I've been a Westerner now for like 30 years. And
well, it's indigenous to New Zealand or Australia. It's a very weird.
That's a common name for Pinot Araucana. Actually, they're native of Chile, of all places.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I saw them in forest in Chile and planted one for my mother-in-law in Chile for a Christmas tree. And yeah, monkey muzzle.
Puzzle tree. Because if you're a listener, you want to go to Google Images and look that up because the branches go in all kinds of directions. And I guess the idea is that if you think about it, it might even trap a monkey. But
you're in a forest of those. You feel like you've been, you're an extra in Jurassic Park filming.
There you go.
The whole forest of those is really weird.
Well, it's funny the things that you remember. So, and that probably a good transition for us to talk about your life immediately after graduating UT.
Yeah, I had wanderlust the entire time I was growing up. My family didn't have a lot of money, so we didn't do much traveling. I'd actually never flown. I'd been out of the state a few times, but really hadn't traveled much. And I knew from an early age that I had to do something that allowed me to travel. And forestry was a real key to that, because back in the day in 67, when I graduated, they were looking for foresters to send to South America. And I applied for the Peace Corps actually in high school.
Okay.
And of course they told me to go to college, and then I maintained contact and was fortunate to be selected to go to Chile, and went down in 67 through 69 for 2 years.
Tell us what you did there.
Oh gosh. I worked for the equivalent to our Forest Service, the National Forest Service. And our mission was to plant Pinot Insignia, Monterey pine, which is a kind of a scrub species in California, which native, where it's native to. But when you take it to Australia or Chile or anywhere south of the equator, it grows like a weed, and it allowed Chile to plant Pinot Insignia all over the country and became an exporter of pulp. They had been an importer before. It would create a pulp tree in about 8 or 9 years. It was incredible.
Fantastic.
And so we had, I had myself and four other volunteers. We had nurseries, and we were spreading Pinot Insignia plantings all over the country.
That just sounds like a fantastic journey. I mean, that's a huge country, mm-hmm. As you well know. I guess it would be fascinating to see.
It's fantastic. If you turned our West Coast upside down, you would pretty much have Chile, including a lot of tree and animal species, and with the mountains to your east and to your west and east, excuse right. me, I'm upside down. And your ocean. You could stand on the beach in Chile and look over your shoulder and see the top of the Andes Mountains with snow on it. So you could actually water ski and snow ski all in one day.
Fantastic.
Such a skinny country.
And, you know, a major life event in your life is you met your wife there.
I sure did. I stole her from her date at her college dance.
And Sonia was a delightful person. I just love Sonia, and I hate to have heard that she passed away recently.
About 3 years ago. Yeah, but I had her for 49 years, so that was incredible. Well,
she was a treasure, and mm-hmm. you brought her home to Nashville. I bet you that was culture shock for her.
I was culture shock for all of us. She thought she spoke English, but she didn't speak Tennessee English.
I see.
Couldn't understand a word.
So. Well, that's just funny. Well, she was a delight. So you came back to Nashville. Did you immediately go to work at Tennessee Conservation, or did you have something in between there?
No, I applied for graduate school from Chile and got an offer for an assistantship at the University of Florida to work on my master's degree. So Sonia and I went directly to Gainesville, and I finished my master's degree there in 2 years. And I had that going before. We came home one Christmas on Christmas break, and Max Young, who had become the state forester I had known at UT, and he called and asked me if I was looking for a job. And I said, yeah, I'm going to finish my degree, and went and interviewed at Department of Conservation with Walt Crowley.
Right.
To be the first administrator of the Land and Water Conservation Fund. And that's where I went when I graduated. Yeah.
Well, I want to talk in great detail about that, because you were really on the ground floor of that program here in Tennessee. And you mentioned Walter Crowley, and I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you to talk a little bit more about Walter and your experience with him.
You know, he was a very quiet, unassuming man, but I credit him more than anybody with, as my mentor, guiding me in the right direction. And I don't think anybody knows how much influence he had on Tennessee and Tennessee State Parks and Trails and that, all those programs, Scenic Rivers, all those programs under his tutelage came to birth. And he fostered a real energetic attempt to try to lift Tennessee State Parks and the conservation movement in Tennessee. But he was never on the front. He was always pushing from the back. And I think I learned from that, that to be a team player, you have to take back seats sometime, but you have to keep pushing. And Walt certainly did that his entire life. I don't think he ever deserved, he ever got enough credit for all he's done and did for Tennessee.
Well, I agree. You may know this, you may not. The Visitor Center at Radnor Lake State Park is named in his honor. It's the Walter Crowley Visitor Center. But every time I go there, you know, I wonder to myself, who in the world knows anything about this wonderful man?
Exactly.
That is so responsible for all these things we take for granted. As you mentioned, the Scenic Rivers, the Trails Program, the entrepreneurial aspects of our state parks with the resorts and golf courses and those sorts of things are all the result of his efforts.
Mm-hmm. Sure are.
We really had quite a crew of individuals working for Walter back in those days.
Yeah, it was his posse.
They called him Walter's Raiders.
There you go.
Crowley's Raiders.
There you go.
What do you remember about some of those individuals? I'm thinking about Mike Countess and...
Tim McCall, Joe Gaines. I still keep in touch with some of the old crew.
Right.
There was a wonderful assortment of individuals that went on to do great things. Jerry Pendleton, who used to work with us, went to the regional office of the National Park Service, made it all the way up to an assistant regional director. Everybody's done well except us.
Many of those people, Alan Coggins, by the way, is another of those people, many of those people came out of the Oak Ridge area. Their parents having been associated with the Oak Ridge nuclear program and had well educated children that were interested in that kind of involvement.
That's true.
Right.
That's very true.
So Jerry, talk to us about, for those people that may not know what the Land and Water Conservation Fund is. In a nutshell, what is it and how were you involved there at the very beginning of it?
When I came on board, the program was about 5 or 6 years old. It was primarily set up from the proceeds of offshore drilling that went directly into an account, but Congress had to appropriate the money from that account every year. So there was a lot of lobbying going on to make sure that they released as much money as possible. When I came on board, inherited about 127 projects, grant projects across the state, because the money flowed through the states for grant to administer. The states had to write an outdoor recreation plan, which had to be approved. And based on that, the criteria were developed to compete local park and recreation systems and state park systems and even game and fish. Anybody that was providing public outdoor recreation in the state was competing for those funds. And I think I lost count, but after a 20-year career there, there was somewhere around 870 projects on the ground. Some of them were land acquisitions. Right. Some of them were a single boat ramp. I can't even remember the smallest, but there were some huge projects, small projects, but there's not a single county and almost not a single city, I don't think, in Tennessee that didn't benefit.
Exactly. So at the beginning, were you like a one-man show?
Yes, I inherited it from another fella, and he became the planner who developed our first state outdoor recreation plan, and I took over the grant program from him. He was doing both. So I inherited those projects, and then it grew from there. And eventually, before I left, I had three regional offices,
right?
One in Knoxville, one in Jackson, and the one in Nashville.
Right. Yeah, I remember Jim Scott was the mm-hmm. the fellow in East Tennessee when I first right. got involved in Tennessee.
Right.
Gene
Hyde was in West.
Yeah. Yeah. And Gene, of course, has been my guest on this program. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess last year, and he became the superintendent of forestry for the city of Chattanooga. Jim went off and got a law degree. Mm-hmm. Imagine that. But I have not heard. I have not heard from Jim in a long time.
Last I heard, he was actually he was serving as an aide for one of the prosecutors in the Watergate, and someone saw him on TV sitting in the back. But he stayed in the belt. I think he stayed around D.C.
Yeah, he was in the Baltimore area last time. His sister graduated from law school. A couple of years after I did. And so I got to know her a little bit, and I would keep up with her, and keep up with him through her. So tell us about some of those projects that were memorable to you.
Oh gosh, Mark, there's so many. Of course, my heart was always in protecting rare and endangered and wild lands in Tennessee. And I think a lot of Savage Gulf, a lot of the projects were large chunks of acquisition of lands that either became state parks or became some scenic river sites along the Hiawassee River was mm-hmm. a great project. Those were all state projects, but in terms of local projects, there were some huge, huge grants. We're talking $500,000 for huge projects. The grounds, A lot of cities didn't even have any parks when we started, and this helped them acquire land and develop ball fields all over the state. And I don't know. There's not Mud Island was another project we worked on that was huge.
Right. Right. And I think there, Riverfront Park in Nashville.
Yeah, and I think the Expo in Knoxville. Some of that project was also funded.
Right, the World's Fair in 1983 mm-hmm. in Knoxville. I do recall that there was a piece of land purchased that was part of the footprint for that development there.
Right. That was over $1 million, and that came directly as a contingency fund. The feds kept, I think, 5% of the land and water fund, and they awarded national contingency grants from that. So we had to administer it, but it came directly from the feds. They didn't have to compete.
So, let's talk just a little bit about the state of affairs of parks and recreation in Tennessee when you first got involved. I mean, you just mentioned in passing that many cities didn't have any parks. I know from my own experience that even some of the cities that had parks had poor to none park management mm-hmm. and little or no recreation programming or programs going on. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that generally, Jerry, and how that progressed over the years?
Well, you played a big part of that, Mark, after you came to work with me, because we can talk about PARTAS. Remember that?
Well, I want to talk about that, certainly, but give us the lay of the land before that.
Well, we recognized because once we gave a land and water grant, it was a 50-50 match. I forgot to mention that. So there was an investment from the local community as well, or the county or the state. But then afterwards, we had to do annual inspections of those sites. And that involved boots on the ground, written inspections back to the Park Service to make sure that that property and those facilities were being maintained and safe and open to the public. There's a clause in the grant contract that if you try to convert that away from public use park, you have to replace it with in kind. of land and another park. So there's it still has that teeth in it. So the inspections were required. And then we began to realize that a lot of communities were struggling because they really didn't have good leadership. Either the public works department or the street, sometimes the street department, or sometimes just volunteers were taking care of grounds. And there wasn't a lot of programming. It was like, okay, you got your little league and you got this, but what is the city doing for you?
Right.
And so we tried to figure out how can we help the cities. We couldn't use any of the land and water money for administration or maintenance or any of that kind of stuff. So bringing you on board and with the idea of assisting communities get professional park and rec people to help operate and maintain the facilities was a real coup.
Well, let's talk about the development of the Parks and Recreation Technical Advisory Service. And I was lucky enough, and I mean lucky, to have been the first person to have that position. Probably the most fun I've ever had in a job in my life. But there was a process involving a couple years of before that became a thing. There was a lot of lobbying and organizational push to get that to happen. Talk about that and the people that were involved and how that came to fruition.
Well, I can't remember much about that,
Okay.
Mark.
Well, maybe I can charge your memory up a little bit.
Please do. Please do.
Well, I think some of the people involved were Charlie Ellenberg, maybe Lyle Richter, who had been at Metro Parks. J.W. Rice was at Chattanooga and knew Senator Albright, who was the state senator from Chattanooga. So, does that refresh your recollection at all?
Remember all those names? I sure do.
Yeah. So were you involved in the lobbying to make that happen?
No, I
No.
wasn't.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it did happen, and 1979, I guess fall of 79, is when that kicked off. Talk about that.
You mean the development of the technical assistance program?
Right.
Yeah, I think a lot of it at the time, the Tennessee Recreation Park Association was active as well, but
Right.
finding and encouraging local governments to take a professional look at a park and recreation director for the first time was a real struggle because it was a strange animal. A lot of our rural community didn't know what that was, never seen it.
Right.
And so the other professionals in the state from the larger cities were very instrumental in demonstrating what can be done and how it can be done. And some of it was on the back of I'm remembering Jackson, it was a public works department. And Gene Hyde and others were secondary to what the public works was doing. And the park and recreation director was brought in and put under public works. So the positioning of a professional was very awkward in a stretch in some cities.
Right. Jerry, I remember one of the first things that, I don't know about whether it was the first things, but it was among the initial things that you and I and others got together and looked at was the methodology of awarding grants to cities and counties. And there was an evaluation process whereby we decided, okay, this is a grant project that we want to fund, and this is one that is not quite as high a priority. There was a committee that met for several weeks to talk about redeveloping that to factor in a larger element of the capability of the town to administer the pro to administer park and recreation programs. Give me some feedback on that.
Now you're jogging. You're jogging the old juices. I thought I was fossilized there for a minute. Yeah, I think the evaluation system is something that I'm very proud of too, because we always had one from the very beginning.
Right.
But I think we were the only state that I knew of that developed an evaluation system by committee. And the committee was the people that were going to be competing with each other actually developed the scoring system and the weighting of the scoring system. It was not developed by staff. We oversaw that, but they had the input and decided what was the most important factors. And every 5 years, we'd take another look at it, because when we realized we were having problems with operation and maintenance, then that weight in the evaluation, the committee felt needed more oomph to it. And so that scoring system was the carrot on the stick, I think, for a lot of people that knew that they were going to continue to get grants. Then they needed to do something to have a professional leadership. So that maybe greased the skids. And Mark, I was very happy that one of the reasons I came out to Arizona was because of our success in the grant program in Tennessee. And I brought with me that evaluation program and replicated it out here.
Tell us more.
The system out here, well, here's one example. The system out here did not allow tribal governments to compete on equal footing with cities.
So interesting.
And I made sure that when I got here, that was one of my first initiatives in the first year. We not only welcomed, but we went out and assisted to make sure we had tribal participation. Because actually, the State Heritage Fund and the Land and Water Fund were the two funding factors out here. And that's from the proceeds of gambling, which are all on Indian reservations. So the money was coming from the tribes, and we weren't giving anything back to the tribes. So I could not tolerate that. So it's one of the first changes that I made when I got here.
That's fascinating. But
the basis for evaluation and weighting, all that came from my early years in Tennessee.
That's fantastic. Jerry, before we move on, after I left Parks, the PARTAS program, there were several others that followed me. One was Joyce Hoyle.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about Joyce. Now, she's passed away at this point, but she was a terrific, hard charging individual in that area, wasn't she?
Oh yeah, yeah. She was a bundle of energy. I met her on a dark night on the side of the road, and she was changing a tire. We were on our way to Humboldt, I believe. We're on our way to meet. She had been pushing Humboldt. She was working as a private consultant at the time to hire a Parks and Rec director, and she got my number and invited me. So on the way to the meeting, she had a flat tire, and that we met. And in the meeting, I saw her in action, and she was not a person who would take no for an answer. She'd find another way to make it happen if you said no.
So fantastic.
She was a ball of fire and a very persuasive person, and I think she did a lot in a lot of small towns to grow the idea of the importance of professional, because she came from North Carolina and had been very involved in all that movement over there. So she brought it.
Well, that's a great testimony to her. Fantastic. And the PARTAS program is still in existence today for our listeners that want to tune in. If you'll go to the state website, you'll find the Parks and Recreation Technical Advisory Service, and they're still going strong. They've sort of melded the grants administration and the assistance to communities a little more together than I would like them to. I think those services ought to be a little bit distinct, but nonetheless, they're out there on the landscape helping these communities, and they have a couple other tools in their toolbox that they didn't have. Back in the early days, and you and I talked about this on the phone the other day. I think you back in the
in the late 80s, there began to be talk about can we be dependent solely on the Land and Water Conservation Fund? And don't we need to have our own source of funding for parks and recreation projects here in Tennessee that isn't relying on the feds? So talk about that. Sure. What happened?
Well, I think from the national perspective, a lot of things begin to happen, and recessions and all that good stuff. And
Ronald Reagan happened. That's one thing that happened.
Yeah. Conservatives didn't see the need as much as Democrats, whatever. But it was always a struggle. And I actually found myself with Walter Crowley on an airplane to actually lobby our congressman to release Land and Water Funds. Several years I made that trip. Didn't ever have to do that before. So things got really tight and the amount of Land and Water Funds began to shrink. And you're right, the call was a lot of states, not just Tennessee, began to look at other sources of revenue, of state revenues that could fill the gap.
You know, I recall that Walter, now that you mentioned his traveling to Washington, I remember how deeply involved he was in a group called NASORLO, the National Association of State Outdoor Recreation Liaison Officers. That's a long title, but he was very much involved with that.
He was. I became the SLO, the slow, right, for Arizona when I moved out here, and was very active in NASORLO, as you mentioned. And right, thanks to that, got to travel to a lot of their meetings all over the U.S. pretty much.
Well, that's a gift. That's a really fun benefit of a job like that.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So what happened in Tennessee? What developed in Tennessee that allowed us to have our own funding source?
I don't think there was any one factor. I know that from a lot of different directions and a lot of nonprofits that were pushing for the things that had been funded, Land and Water, there was a Scenic Rivers program, and there's a whole cadre of individuals and organizations that had that singular purpose to protect the scenic rivers. There was a Trails Association that had organized, and multiple local units of that. And those were all funded from Land and Water. So the citizen response and outcry was, we need to shore up because we're not going to be able to continue to push for these programs. The Natural Areas Program, I should have mentioned that too.
Right.
Protected Radnor Lake and other beautiful places around the state. They were coming to fruition because of the seed money, the Land and Water. Well, if you take the seed money away, obviously you have to have something to replace it.
Right.
And homegrown was the way every other state was looking at it. And so we began to look at how other states were coming up with their own funding sources. And that's when the real estate tax, property tax, we looked at a lot of different options, but it wasn't the state that was looking at it. It was all the nonprofits and all the pressure groups, we call them,
right,
and all the support groups.
Well, I can remember meeting with you and others to begin to draft that legislation, that actually captured an increment of the real estate transfer tax.
Yes.
And dedicated it, as you said, to local parks and rec, some to historic preservation, some to the acquisition of natural areas, even archaeological areas, and that finally did pass. And I was looking today to figure out about what year that was, and the best I could figure it was around 88 or 89, maybe 90.
It was late 80s for sure. Yeah. Late 80s, because I left in 95, and It was on its way.
Going strong by that point.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And so today, state government has an abundance of money. There's actually more money in that program today than there is in the federal side program.
And that's true all over the United States. Right. It's true out here for sure. And we look at land and water money is leaking out, although we have hopes it's coming back this year. As a tip on top of all the state funding that's coming in. So states were and localities were smart in generating their own funding source, because you can't really depend on Congress to keep these programs alive.
Right, right. Well, and Tennessee is just doing fantastic in terms of local parks right now.
Right.
Even our state parks are being able to acquire properties adjacent to the parks that maybe have natural attributes that are worthwhile to preserve, or maybe be in threat of development, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. As it should be.
Right. So Jerry, you moved to Arizona. Tell us what got you out there.
I think after I finished 21 years at the Department of Conservation at the time, my wife and I were ready for scenery change. I was never one to put down roots. I always had wanderlust. And so I began to explore opportunities in other states. I interviewed for a similar job to mine for the state of Virginia, came in second. And then Joyce Hoyle, the force be with her, had run into Ken Travis, you may remember.
Yes.
Was working at state parks in Tennessee, and he and Don Sharpio was director, and went from there to Arizona and brought Ken out to Arizona. And Joyce ran into Ken at some parks at NRPA conference, and he said they were looking for a new administrator of their grants, planning and grants section. She came back with the news, and I applied and interviewed and thought about it. They offered me the job, and my wife and I decided to go. So we pulled up stakes and came out in 95, 96. And it was rough for a while. It was hard for a guy who's raised in the hills of Tennessee to adapt to this dry desert out here. And it's at first glance, it's ugly, it's hot, it's dusty. But if you've ever been into the Superstition Mountains at 5 o'clock in the afternoon when the sun is setting and the mountains turn purple and orange and green, I fell in love with Arizona and couldn't leave. I wasn't planning on staying. I took a 2-year contract, but gets in your blood.
So Jerry, you stayed with the Parks Division in Arizona for several years and then went on to work for the city of Mesa.
Right, right. I think actually there was a job in between. Okay. After 5 years at state parks, we developed a conservation corps that brought kids off the street and trained them to build trails on national parks at the Grand Canyon and national parks around the nation. And I was brought over from state parks to head up their VISTA program. Had 27 VISTA volunteers, 437 street kids. And we hardened them and sent them out to build trail on public lands. That program lasted for about 2 years, and then the governor abolished it for political reasons, and I was out of a job.
I see.
And so I went back on my grants career, development career, and the city of Mesa was developing their first grants coordinator. So I came out to the city of Mesa and coordinated all their grants across all their departments out of a city manager's office for 20 years, another 20-year career.
So you're talking about not just parks and rec, but also housing and sewer and water and
police and fire.
Everything. Wow.
Everything. Yeah. Which really expanded my brain, my mind.
And, well, tell us more. That's, it's so interesting because it's so interesting to hear you. hadn't ever heard you talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
But before I came to work for you, I had been doing community development type grants at for Sevierville. So I knew a little bit about that, but you learned about it after leaving Parks and Recreation. So did you have some fun doing that?
Oh yeah, it was a challenge. I guess I was up for it. I don't think I would be now. It was prior to computers taking over the grants world, which is one reason I decided to hang it up and retire when I did, or I'd still be there probably. Although I'm 76, they probably wouldn't have me. But when computers took over and the art and talent of writing grants and seeking grants became data driven and mechanical,
Right.
I just couldn't take it anymore. And so I enjoy the art of developing grant programs, applying for grants, and helping people, leading people to the opportunities. And that's what I did. So I had
Fantastic.
a great career there, but it was enough.
So Jerry, you've retired now and tell us what you're doing in your retirement.
Oh gosh. Well, yes, the last time we talked the other day, I had to cut you off early because I had a meeting down at the we developed a huge art center here in Mesa. I am a volunteer usher and tour guide at the Mesa Art Center, where I get to use my bilingual skills. We talked a little bit. I still teach Spanish a little bit on the side. I have neighbors and friends that come over for Spanish classes. My wife and I had a business, a side business, teaching Spanish called Spanish for Survival to companies. And we would take our classes out to your work site and on the job, teach your employees how to deal with the public, because out here it's essential. It's essential for everybody that deals with the public to have a working knowledge of Spanish.
Right.
So I'm continuing that, and I have grandkids in San Diego. I spend a lot of time between here and San Diego traveling. I don't get to Tennessee much. Maybe after COVID, I'll get back.
Fantastic. Well, Jerry, you've been so great to spend some time with us today, and I hope when you get back in town on a visit, you'll stop in and look in and see us, so maybe we can have an in-person interview. Be fun to see you.
How about some Cincinnati chili, Mark?
Well, we can certainly do that. You're bringing that to light. I guess back when I first came to Nashville, that was one of the ways I shared a little hospitality with the other people on the staff was to invite everybody over for a bowl of chili.
Unipol, I'll never forget
And
that.
well, you, the Little King's ale. That's what I was. I always had plenty of that.
Oh yeah.
Well, Jerry, thank you for spending some time with me.
Thank you for digging me up.
All right.
Keep in touch, buddy.